Hello again and welcome to this episode of Watch the Media. I'm John Schrader. I had a rather lengthy conversation this summer with journalist Karim Zidane, a native of Egypt, college educated in Canada, and now works in journalism around sports and politics and the effects of them.
The coverage of the International Olympic Committee and FIFA, which are two mafias and two extraordinarily powerful mafias in this world right now, if they are allowed to continue having the type of autonomy they have in sports, and by that I mean autonomy in the sense that there's no accountability and no transparency whatsoever in how they do anything, we are doomed. China uses its absolute leverage, its economic leverage of being able to tell the NBA, well, you're not going to listen to us, we're just going to shut you down. And the NBA will feel that. That's a blow they will feel. Sports washing is a bit of a crude term because it limits us to this idea that all these authoritarian regimes, what they're really interested in is reputation laundering. And I have to be very honest with you here. I don't think most of them give a damn what the West thinks about them. Truly, I don't think Saudi Arabia could care less. And we're seeing right now from its foreign policy, from its demands of the United States, from all sorts of things that it could not care less what the United States thinks of it. The rules of capitalism are out of the window. You've got the US trying to compete in this capitalist landscape that they understand, competing against an opponent with a bottomless pit of money right now. It's an absolute bottomless pit of money. The approach is so different, which is why you came to the situation that you had at the PGA LIV Golf. People keep calling it a merger. What it was a hostile takeover. The PGA simply had no choice here.
You might have a little bit of an idea from those brief clips about the conversation we had. We talked about a lot of things, including sports and politics, sports washing, the New York Times giving up its sports department coverage to The Athletic, of course, Saudi Arabia and Messi and China and the NBA, and a whole lot more. I've split the conversation into two episodes. As always, listen to them as you like, when you like, for as long as you like, kind of the way this podcasting thing works. Enjoy. Karim Zidane is an investigative journalist who writes at the intersection of sports and politics. And as much as so many people I hear say sports and politics don't mix, Karim knows otherwise. And he's here to talk about that and a number of other things with us. And we appreciate the time. Thanks.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, John. Thank you so much for having me.
So sports and politics do mix and have always mixed, haven't they?
They always have. I find that when I speak to people, particularly in North America, you know, the United States, Canada, et cetera, the ones who tend to accept that sports and politics do mix refer to something sort of like a veil lifting for them. Sort of like, oh, I can see sports in a whole new lens. It's sort of this one incident snowballs into others. The difference really is I grew up in a place like Egypt where there was no veil to begin with. You never had the privilege to separate sports from politics. Politics sort of infested every aspect of your life, whether you like it or not. And sports was absolutely one of them.
Let's talk about that a little bit, because you, as a youngster, you grew up in Egypt. And when did you leave there and how did you end up in North America?
So my parents, honestly, it's a story of, you know, Egypt's history in many ways and just the amount of migration we've been doing with the economy going down, dating back to the 80s. My parents were, you know, a doctor and a university professor, and they sought better opportunities outside of Egypt. So when we were very young, we moved to the Gulf. I ended up moving back to Egypt at around 15 years old, where I finished high school. And it was really at that point, around 15, that I started seeing these issues that intersect between sports and politics. So honestly, really, this pathway begins for me at around 15 years old. I specifically remember, I'll give you one example here, John. I specifically remember attending a football match, and football, I'm talking soccer here. It's a soccer game that was involved Al Ahly, which is, you know, the most popular football team in Egypt. Really, really extremely, extremely popular. And I was always a big fan of them growing up. And they happened to be playing Barcelona. And this is in around 2007. And it was the Barcelona with a very, very young, very new Messi. So this is Really the birth of a superstar, and everybody in Egypt wanted to come see the superstar play live. And I was one of them. And we went to Cairo Stadium, 90,000 people there to watch Al Ahly, Egypt's favorite club, play against Barcelona. Who else was in attendance but Hosni Mubarak, who was then president of Egypt, and he had reigned for 30 years like a pharaoh up until the Arab Spring, would happen just a few years later. But at that point, he was still sort of at the height of his power. And you know that he's coming to an event because you had to leave six, you had to be at the stadium 6 hours before showtime, before kickoff, basically, just because he wanted empty streets by the time he rolled in half an hour before the game or whatever, to wave at everybody and the whole crowd. And whenever he's there, the police presence and the security presence always a lot more intense. I remember at one point during the game, it might have been halftime, might have been shortly thereafter, and I was there with cousins and with friends and all sorts of things. I walk and I'm on my way to the bathroom, and while I'm on this pathway, you're passing the area where sort of the Egyptian hooligans, I guess the fan groups, were known to be, and these were more revolutionary like fans than they are hooligans in that sense. We're talking about a group of young men who weren't interested in fighting each other and fighting other groups the way you have hooligans in the UK and elsewhere. These were people who were specifically looking to find a voice for the voiceless and to target, police, police brutality, police oppression, etc. So they were very vocal about the government and how much they disliked the government. So of course the police spots a few people with banners, etc. They pull them out from the crowd in front of my eyes and beat the crap out of them with a baton. This is me at 15 witnessing this. Couldn't believe it, couldn't understand what I was witnessing, was just trying to get by this melee that begins in this onslaught of just police officers kicking and attacking these two like fans that they pulled out of the stand. And those, they looked my age. Like they were absolutely teenagers as well. And that was absolutely shocking for me. So it was really this, the intersection of sports and politics became evidently clear for me at 15. So half the age I am right now. So it's been an aspect of my life for a very, very long time. North America for me occurred, when I turned 18, I decided I wanted to go study in North America. One of the universities that accepted me at the time was the University of Toronto, and I saw that as my best opportunity, so I stuck with it and moved on. And of course, this development of this fascination with politics led me to study political science, economic development. I actually didn't study journalism heading into journalism, interestingly enough. So my pathway is a bit of a less typical one, let's put it that way.
So then, where the journalism and how the journalism, where did that get into the mix?
So I tend to be always honest about this. Journalism wasn't my first love. My love has always been writing. Ever since I was a kid, I loved writing. My mother's an English professor, and I reading was an addiction of mine, an obsession of mine. And I used to love writing even, short fiction from when I was a little kid. I still write fiction to this day. It's what I enjoy doing the most, I'd say. But as I was in university and I found that I really wasn't interested in what I was studying very much, there was very little driving me. But what was interesting me at the time was sports. And I thought, there might be a way that I can merge these two things that I'm interested and passionate about right now, this sort of this love of sports and this love of writing. Maybe I can do some sports writing, some sports journalism. That seems like a reasonable entryway into the world of writing. And that's really how it is, how it went through. Before I even graduated from university, I had already joined Bloody Elbow, which is this sports blog, this mixed martial arts blog that was really skyrocketing at the time and was part of Vox Media. And I just started doing writing for them, and I was doing tennis writing on the side. And I thought, you know what? There might be a future for me doing this. This is far more fun than me trying to be a political science scientist or entering the field of economics.
So then the investigative part of it comes in where? Because being an investigative journalist, as anybody who's ever tried it knows, it takes a lot of things, including patience, and the courage and self-esteem. So where did that happen? How did that tributary get found?
It was quite organic, I have to say. So, sort of my first year writing for Bloody Elbow, I decided, you know what, I want to interview this founder of this mixed martial arts organization in Russia. Just because he was specifically well known in the United States, the UFC and Dana White had this big feud going on with him at the time, and I thought, you know what, nobody's ever thought to interview him. Let me try and do that. So I reached out to the organization. They set up the interview, and because he speaks Russian, we've got a translator while we're on the call. And in the middle of the call, him and the translator just keep having this back and forth, and I'm like, "What's going on here?" They're like, "Oh, sorry, one second." They finish this conversation, and then the translator turns to me, who happens to also be the PR person for this organization, turns to me and says, "You know, Vadim, who's the oligarch who runs this organization, he really likes your voice and would love for you to be, you know, would you ever be interested in doing commentary for us, like English commentary?" And I'm at this point, I'm what? I'm 22, maybe, not 100% sure I'm going to be a sports journalist. Again, journalism wasn't my fascination or the be all end all for me at the time. I thought to myself, well, how often do you get these opportunities to go to a place like Russia and on someone else's dime on top of that? And this is 2014 when this happened. And I said, yes. Well, I told them, listen, give me some time. Let me think about it. 2 days later, maybe I said yes. And we started this visa process. And this was that me saying yes then absolutely changed my life. It opened up pathways that absolutely would not have existed without it. By going to Russia that one time, it opened up these opportunities for me to go to Russia over the next 2 to 3 years. Like I would go to Russia regularly, at least a dozen times between 2014 and late 2016. Those experiences were life-changing. I was able to meet a wide range of different people. I mean, I was at one point, I got into a political debate with an ex-KGB agent who would only like answer my questions when we'd go shot for shot. So the more I drank with him, the more willing he was to have a conversation with me. That was a bizarre experience from the get-go. I met a bunch of different oligarchs while I was there. I got intimidated by Ramzan Kadyrov's henchmen while I was there. There was all sorts of situations that I found myself in that very unlikely would have occurred as, you know, your average sports journalist just sitting on his computer or traveling to different sports events, being able to immerse myself in Russia. And interestingly enough, John, immersing myself as somebody who they didn't take as a journalist at the time, but as a sports commentator. So I was able to go out to these dinners and go out and ask people questions. I'm not saying I took those questions and turned them immediately into stories, but it all kept percolating in my head. For years and years, and I sort of built this understanding of the dark side of fight sports and fight game and generally sports in Russia. To put this in a bit more context, I arrived in Russia the very first time in 2014, December 2014, on a day called Black Tuesday. The reason it was called Black Tuesday was because the ruble had crashed so dramatically that people were committing suicide, and just people were just emptying out furniture stores, emptying their bank accounts. Of course, Russia's gone through significant roller coasters since then, but at the time, it was a very big deal. I'm walking around trying to tour St. Petersburg while people are living their absolute best, their worst days at that point. So, really, was a jarring experience. And the reason that happened was because of Vladimir Putin's annexation of Crimea. So that the political aspect was always there for me. And just being able to immerse myself in Russian culture and deal with all these people really built out what would become my journalism career when I moved back to Canada.
What was the fascination with mixed martial arts, MMA, and where, you know, how'd you get into that?
I think the fascination really lied in the fact that it was a sport I hadn't watched before. Like I started the story telling you about just this conversation telling you about my love of football and attending those matches and well again I'll say so I'm trying to say soccer here I keep forgetting but that was the sport I really loved and other than that then my other favorite sport was tennis. That was what I viewed as the individual sport, the sport that if I'm watching one individual this is the kind of sport I want to watch. But then when I first got to university, in my very first year at University of Toronto, I'm sitting with some friends and they're like, "Oh, there's this big UFC event on." I'm like, "What's the UFC?" They're like, "Oh, you're gonna love this." And we're just sitting having some drinks, whatever. And I remember there was this one specific fight. And I look at them, I'm like, "Are you trying to tell me that this is any different to the WWE where I can't tell you right now who's gonna win?" And they're like, "Who is gonna win then?" And I tell them, obviously the big guy is gonna win with all the muscles, not the guy with a little belly there, like next to him. And sure enough, the guy with the belly was much smaller, throws one punch, sends the other guy down, chokes him out, completely unconscious, and my jaw drops. And I'm like, "What on earth is this sport?" So it was sort of this strange fascination with something I hadn't seen or heard of before. And I thought to myself, well, there could be a better entry point here. You know, football, basketball, these are all established traditional sports that are covered well by the media. We were at the point where there was a rise of, you know, sports blogs. Vice and Vox Media were on the rise with venture capital funding. It seemed like we were entering a new age of digital sports journalism, and I wanted to be a part of that. And MMA felt like this niche new sport that you could make your name in a lot faster than, say, these other traditional sports.
Karim Zidane's sports newsletter is called Sports Politica, and that's spelled P-O-L-I-T-I-K-A. Almost stumbled over my own spelling of that. He's an investigative sports journalist. Again, writes at the intersection of sports and politics. Now, you mentioned Kadyrov because then you got to know so much. You learned so much that you then broke some news regarding Kadyrov, and he's not very happy about it either, is it? Tell us about that.
My experience with Ramzan Kadyrov dates back to my very first trip to Russia in 2014. I'm sitting trying to do my commentary, and is my first experience really that close to cage side? It's intense. The crowd in Russia is very intense. Even the people in the very front row, they're riled up, they're ready to go, they're shouting obscenities, the whole experience. And then you have these henchmen, this group of maybe three, four people who entered. Kadyrov wasn't with them, but it was well known that these were some of Kadyrov's closest allies. And they were there because one of Kadyrov's favorite fighters at the time, this was shortly before he started his own personal fight club, which I'm going to get into more detail about. But he had a fighter competing on this show, and his henchmen came to just see how it was going, basically. The second they arrived, to this day, we're talking... This happened in 2014, so this is 9 years ago. And I remember the feeling in my chest when they showed up. I had no idea who they were, but the fact that the whole front row went quiet. It was just sort of this eerie silence in the middle of a fight. In the middle of a cage fight, there's suddenly this silence. And they're so satisfied with the fact that it's gone silent. They're sitting their chests out, you know, like these roosters basically just walking around like they're cock of the walk at this event. And I remember turning to my commentary partner, who was Russian. I had two different ones, but this one was Russian at the time. I turned to him and said, what's going on here? He's like, don't look at them. Don't worry about it. I'll talk to you about this later. These are just very bad people. And all I was thinking about in my head is, why are these bad people even here? Like, what could they possibly want with this event? Eventually, over time, I was able to sort of get enough information out of my colleagues, out of different people involved. And I found out about this person named Ramzan Kadyrov, who's this Chechen warlord who sort of emerged out of the two Chechen wars that occurred between Chechnya and Russia. And for people who don't know, Chechnya is a republic within Russia, but in the North Caucasus of Russia, this enclave, Muslim majority enclave that's really been troubled over the years, has a history of, you know, these mountaineer warriors and strong, very masculine culture, and just got annihilated by Russian imperialism that later on Putin would manifest once again. If people talk about Putin emerging as his own warlord, well, Putin's very first experiment as a warlord was carpet bombing Grozny, the capital of Chechnya. The damage he did there was horrific. And he instilled a puppet leader afterwards, who was Ramzan Kadyrov's father. Ramzan Kadyrov's father gets blown up in 2004. And over the next 3 years, there's a power vacuum that Ramzan Kadyrov himself ends up filling. Over the next few years, he starts building this cult of personality around himself and around his father. And what he ties very closely to this cult of personality is his obsession with mixed martial arts and fight sports and combat sports in general. To him, it was a form of sports socialization. He was turning Chechnya into this place where masculinity was represented through your ability to defend yourself or to defend your country and defend your honor. So for Ramzan Kadyrov, that ended up manifesting in two things. He started this personal fight club in 2015. A fight club, by that I mean sort of this gym. Legitimate big training facility that could hold up to 5,000 Chechen men to train in mixed martial arts and boxing, etc. He would then go on to start his own MMA organization, his own boxing organization, all this to make himself look good. He just wanted to look like this magnanimous, sports-loving leader to distract his own population from within, a population that's very oppressed, mind you, that has very little that they can do or enjoy. So by giving them sports and entertainment and this type of violence, Kadyrov is hoping to keep them away from, other issues such as, rebelling, dissenting, or even worse, Islamic, militarism or anything like that, which all has taken place in the North Caucasus. So this isn't just about, presenting himself as a magnanimous leader abroad, but this is something that he does to control his own population. So I call it the sports socialization. So I thought Ramzan Kadyrov was particularly disturbing and fascinating because of just how closely he associated mixed martial arts with his own government. Like his organization, his fight club, was really an extension of his regime. And that became a story I could not resist writing. I learned about this over the years while I was going to write. I mean, I started going in 2014. He started his fight club in 2015. By 2016, I had gotten a good sense of what was going on, and I had built a network of sources, people who were willing to talk to me, that included Chechens. Through that, I was able to further my investigation. And at one point, I got back to Canada after one trip, and especially after one really deep conversation I had with one of my Russian colleagues, who was telling me about, the lack of opportunities for Russian journalists themselves to tell different stories, and how they rely on help from abroad for a lot of these different stories. I thought to myself, this Ramzan Kadyrov thing's never going to get told. No one in the MMA space cares to really write a good investigative piece, but I've got an opportunity right now to make something of this. And I started teaching people about how Ramzan Kadyrov is using sports as a weapon at the end of the day. He's using mixed martial arts as this way to build his own political regime and his agenda. The story didn't catch fire immediately. It did catch fire when Ramzan Kadyrov started purging gay people in his republic in 2017. By the time he was doing that, he was also getting people, some of his own fighters, into the UFC. And here's where I started seeing a connection that would make sense for people. The UFC is now signing fighters that are affiliated to a warlord who's executing gay people. There's your headline right there. That caught the attention of HBO Real Sports, who wanted to do a documentary on this, and that ended up I participated in the documentary. I helped research the documentary for them. I took them through quite a variety of steps in the process. Gave them all the information they could to really build out a good documentary. It's an award-winning piece that we're all still very, very proud of, and it built and it you know it gave me my head start in the space. Really, at this point, I was taken as a serious journalist rather than just an MMA blogger or a blogger of sorts. This Kadyrov story happened to be my very big break. What was strange to me is that it doesn't seem to end. There's always some sort of evolution or development in Ramzan Kadyrov. I mean, at some point we can circle back and talk about his influence in the Russia-Ukraine war right now, but unfortunately, this is a story that hasn't left me since 2014.
And you have to be sure that his folks aren't keeping close tabs on you. Maybe they are still.
I have dealt with death threats from them. I've been open about this in my writing and in previous interviews that I've received death threats from his henchmen. I've received those very chilling statements that they love to give out in Chechnya, which is, oh, you should really apologize for this. This is very bad for you. You must apologize. It's for your own good. We will wait for your apology. Send it in a video, please. They'll actually make those demands of you. Send it in a video. And here's why Ramzan Kadyrov loves taking those videos, posting them online and saying, listen, see, this person said this awful thing about me, but look at how magnanimous I am. He just apologizes and that's it. It's over. No jail, no nothing for him. But for him, he's presenting himself, sure, as this, benevolent, nice guy who's not going to do all these awful things. But it's really an intimidation tactic, not just for the person who apologized, but it's a warning sent out to everybody else saying, you speak out, you'll be the next person on my screen right here. So I knew I did not want to be one of those videos. Now, that didn't mean to me that I was going to stop writing. To me, it meant, screw off. I'm not stopping what I'm doing. People have asked me many times, oh, that's so brave. That sounds so brave. How could you do that? Very few people are that brave. I think, honestly, and my opinion here. I think I was young and dumb, just generally. There's a point in time, at a certain age, you're doing things, you're not thinking too hard about them. To me, I've always known I've had this sort of distaste for authority in general, even as in my teenage years and onwards. Speaking out has never been that hard for me. It's been just generally what I do. And Ramzan Kadyrov was one of those stories that I just didn't want to let go of. The idea that I was going to just be silenced by a message or by people's messages or attempts that easily, no, it needed to be something more significant. I ended up stopping going to Russia and protecting myself in many different ways. Like, I took the precautions that were required. But when I look back on it now, on that decision, when I get asked this question, why would you continue doing this stuff? It's hard not to say that the part of it was sort of this being young and dumb and thinking that you're going to live through whatever. Anyway, maybe some people look back and say, that some of those things you did weren't too smart at that point. Maybe you could have handled this a little bit better. Maybe you shouldn't have written that story while you were in Russia. There was one story I published. I was in Moscow at the time, and I spent the next 4 days in Moscow, like, looking over my shoulder, just for no reason. Like, I was convinced somebody was after me, especially since we were staying in this giant old Soviet style hotel, which really didn't help, like, Cold War era, like, stereotypes as well at that time.
So does Kadyrov have a relationship, business or otherwise, with Dana White of UFC?
I'd say that the UFC is extremely friendly with Ramzan Kadyrov's fighters. I mean, they might not have a official relationship, but the UFC currently has what, six, seven of Ramzan Kadyrov's fighters. They've been repeatedly told. We did a piece, two pieces actually, for the New York Times, dealing with how Ramzan Kadyrov has been sanctioned repeatedly in the United States, both by the Treasury and the State Department, for a variety of different things dating back to 2017. His fight club has been sanctioned as of 2020. So is his MMA organization, so is his boxing organization. They've all been sanctioned. Yet all these fighters who officially represent his fight club, this thing called Ahmed MMA, they still compete for the UFC, and they do so on US soil. Ramzan Kadyrov's fighter, he gets to reap sort of this pride and prestige from his fighters competing and winning at a UFC event on US soil, despite him being a warlord and involved in Russia's invasion of Ukraine. It's a bizarre story because you think this would be so simple to stop. You think it's within the US government's capabilities to stop this. But whether it is about the bureaucracy involved, just how slow governments move, or whether the UFC is so small at this point that it's not even on the government's radar, it's unclear to me why the State Department and Treasury hasn't taken action against the UFC. Because the UFC sure as shit isn't going to do anything about it. They have no interest. They couldn't care less. The UFC is the most reactionary sports organization there is. This is the organization where Dana White slapped his wife and they did nothing about it.
Well, and they sold it to Endeavor,
Exactly.
right? For billions of dollars, right? Aren't they
Absolutely.
owned by Endeavor? And
They
WWE
are.
is now owned by them.
Endeavor chooses to ignore absolutely every request for comments we send in, including from the New York Times, believe it or not. At least the UFC had the courtesy to send the New York Times a statement after weeks of waiting, but they sent a statement nonetheless.
Yeah.
But Endeavor has no interest in even concerning itself with the UFC's business.
Zidane does some writing for the New York Times. I'm going to ask him about what happened in the New York Times sports department in just a minute here. He's written for The Guardian, also worked for Vox Media and others. His newsletter at the intersection of sports and politics is called Sports Politica, Politika. It's on Substack. And if you just Google Sports Politica with K, or Karim Zidane, you'll find where you can get his work. Did you not write that the Wagner Group, the infamous mercenary group in that was fighting in Ukraine, is replete with MMA fighters?
Yes, it's become one of the strange things over the past couple of years where Russia's invasion of Ukraine happens to include this sort of very strange vector of combat sports in it, where There is a variety of different ways that combat sports actually intersects with this war. One that I mentioned earlier was Ramzan Kadyrov, who's using his, you know, personal fight club, this fight club that he initially started, to end up getting fighters into the UFC and to build this sort of new Chechnya and new masculinity in Chechnya. Well, guess what? He's also recruiting for his army from his fight club. So that was a way to sit, like, sort of funnel fighters, especially the ones who weren't going to, you know, offer him that pride and prestige in the cage, weren't good enough to compete in a cage for him in the United States, etc. He was more than happy to send those out to fight for him in the battlefield and become his cannon fodder, basically. So that's one example right there. The other is, of course, the Wagner Group. And most people had, there's been a ton of reporting about how they were recruiting from prisons. But after a while, they had stopped doing that. And I got wind of this when Wagner themselves announced that they had gotten into a sort of this partnership with one particular gym in Russia. And I thought to myself, if they're doing it with one, it's very likely they're doing it with a bunch. And as I started looking through, I found that recruitment centers were and posters for recruitment for recruitment to Wagner were being installed in at least 50 gyms across Russia. Now, we're not talking just MMA gyms. It actually becomes a little more sinister when you think of the fact that it includes martial arts gyms and general gyms. Why? Because they include a lot more children than MMA gyms. And that's disturbing in and of itself, but it's makes a lot of sense for Wagner, which is not only trying to promote itself to the current echelon of fighters that it could potentially recruit, but it's trying to instill this mentality into a younger generation as well. So there's a lot of these gyms that participated in this that train kids in martial arts. Like, it's like sending your kid to a taekwondo class and it just so happens to have a recruitment center for a militia within it. That's just horrific stuff. But that's what Russia is dealing with right now. And for those who think that this was, you know, a decision taken independently of the government, some of those facilities were in official sort of government sports buildings. So, like, you know, the Russian Boxing Federation, official government institute in that sense, the Russian Boxing Federation's office in Tyum, for instance, is one of those recruitment centers. Now, that sort of shows this correlation between sports, the military, and Putin and power sort of in Russia, and how these all intersect together. It was a difficult story to write. It was one of those more shocking stories that I've written. But again, it goes to show you just how combat sports really intersects with the world around us in a way that I would never have imagined when I first started covering this thing. It's shocking the place these sports, particularly mixed martial arts, have been given in sort of this new modern masculinity, or this sort of counterculture masculinity we're dealing with in the world right now.
So
including war.
Okay, so let's flip it around here and come to the Western Hemisphere. And I just, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, are these extreme sort of militia types, these war-mongering types, recruiting Americans or North Americans in sports gyms?
Interestingly enough, if they could, they would. But what's actually been happening is there is another subsect of neo-Nazis and extremists in the United States and in Canada that are forming their own MMA gyms so that they could train themselves and prepare for the coming civil war, basically.
Oh, so it doesn't start in the gyms. They create the gyms after they've...
They see it as a way... Exactly. Wow. They're seeing gyms as a way to sort of foster community amongst like-minded, you know, fascists and extremists. Mm-hmm. It's another way to welcome in disenfranchised youth looking for a purpose and a goal. That goal could be something as simple as, you know, I don't feel good in my body, I don't look good, nobody's taking me seriously. People be like, come, we are your family now, we love you, we respect you, we'll get you to lose weight, we'll get you that goal, we'll teach you how to fight, and if you can't, you know, if you don't get what you want in this world, we'll teach you how to get it by force, basically. It's that kind of, people think it's enriching their lives getting into this sort of really toxic space, but it's not. And at the end of the day, the goal is always exactly the same. They push these horrific ideologies. They push, you know, anti-LGBTQ rhetoric. They push, you know, anti-vaccine rhetoric. They push anti-black rhetoric, anti-Semitic rhetoric. It's really disgusting spaces all in all. And you see that from the type of propaganda that they put out there, these groups called active clubs. And these active clubs were started by a guy called Robert Rundo in the United States. He was arrested just a couple of years ago, just actually a couple of months ago in Romania. But so sort of the one head of the snake has been cut off at this point. But let's see where these active clubs go on from there. He would spend years teaching people that mixed martial arts is going to be one of these emancipation tools for the white man in the future, and how it is a way for us to get our message across. It's part of being part of the new right and the alt-right. And they really saw themselves as building these fight clubs for the alt-right, this modern right wing that was emerging with the first Donald Trump presidency. The 2016 sort of tenure of Donald Trump in office is when you were seeing a lot of these groups taking shape and taking to the streets to protest and to counter protest and just to make their presence seen. We're seeing them still to this day, but now instead of, they're no longer at Berkeley and at the Unite for the Unite the Right rallies and those big major rallies at Charlottesville, etc. Now they're showing up at drag queen story hours.
Yeah.
Like the messaging at the end is always the same, which is why I said it's been bizarre watching combat sports emerge as this tool utilized by these counterculture movements and these extremist movements that all seem to be heading in the same direction of hate always. And it's so easy to turn people to hate through these sports. I don't understand why necessarily these sports in particular. There's been other sports, of course. This is not to say that mixed martial arts is the only way. As a matter of fact, one of the founders of sort of this extremism in mixed martial arts is a guy called Denis Nikitin. He was radicalized. He's a Russian who was radicalized in Germany's football hooligan scene. So it was actually football that radicalized this guy. So football plays a massive part in this. But even when you think of football, it's not like they're kicking balls at each other. They would set up these, group fights before and after games. That was what these hooligans in the UK and Europe were known for, these big street fights. And it was about which hooligan group was stronger than the other. So it was, again, at the end of the day, it was manifesting the same type of violence that you're seeing through combat sports.
Thank you so much for being with us on this episode of Watch the Media, and hope you'll catch part two of our conversation with Karim Zidane.